Professor Bengt Formberg from the University of Colorado. Bengt did an undergraduate degree at Uppsala University, and what he tells me is a linear superposition of applied math and computer science with neither, and then went on also to get a PhD in the same subject from the University of Uppsala University. He then did a postdoc at
CERN
in Switzerland. In applied math, they were building up their applied math capabilities, so he was there for a couple of years. And then he went to Caltech for about 10 years, and Exxon in New Jersey for 12 years. And he's been in the applied math department at the University of Colorado for the past 6.5 years. And he's going to talk to us today about radial basis functions and something about spectral methods.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, radial basis functions, and I'll explain in a little while what that's all about. And the question is if that could be a future way to solve partial differential equations numerically. And let me start by acknowledging my collaborators, Toby Driscoll, postdoc who is now at the University of Delaware, Elizabeth Larson, Natasha Flyers, postdocs working with me, and a couple of graduate students, Grady Wright and Richard Charles. Start by a little bit of an overview here. Numerical methods to solve PDEs numerically are three probably dominant technologies: finite elements, finite differences, and spectral methods. And finite elements are very elegant. You can get nice error estimates, you can prove convergence, you have great geometric flexibility. But it's very hard to get up the order of accuracy beyond second order accuracy. And coding can be very complex. If you are in three dimensions, mesh generation, and especially bringing up the accuracy, is very difficult. Finite differences, simple, direct, user-friendly. Very easy to get a high-order stencil. Just make the stencil a little bit longer. Very easy. However, if you have a complex geometry, gridding, especially irregular boundaries, is difficult. Now, spectral method is to push the idea of finite. There are different ways to introduce spectral method, and one way is to just take a finite difference stencil and just make it wider, the stencil, until it covers the whole domain, and it automatically becomes a spectral method. A problem there is that it only works well in very simple geometries. I mean, periodic interval, periodic square, a circle, or something like that. Now, radial basis function is a totally new competitor in the field. And what they offer is spectral accuracy. Geometry can be completely general. Coding is very simple. So the demo codes, demo small things I'll show you, we are talking about 10 lines of MATLAB. And that is with completely spectral accuracy. We throw in our points as we please. And it's still that simple to code it up. There's no more complicated to do it in 1, 2, 3, even if you want to do it in 6 dimensions. Coding just makes it no more complicated. But it's a great promise, but it's not ready for prime time yet. And we can solve parabolic equations, we can solve elliptic equations very effectively. We cannot yet time step a wave equation in a stable way. So there's lots of work to remain to get it to be a general purpose method. In the beginning, the concept started in 1968, and that was Roland Hardy, who had a cartography problem, and that was at the various places he had elevation measurements, and you wanted to make a map, and you wanted to draw the contour lines, so you wanted to interpolate between the scattered height locations in a smooth way. And up to that point, the drawing of contours was required the skill of the mapmaker, and different mapmakers caused a little bit different contour lines. You would like to have an automatic way to do this. So let's put that one aside here, because I'm going to come back to this picture in a little bit. To tell now what the radial basis function is, it's a good way to start is to look at a cubic spline in one dimension. And if you have data like these points here, the cubic spline is a piecewise cubic, so it's a cubic then it allows a jump in the third derivative. Then comes another cubic, allowed jump in the third derivative, and so forth. They are very effective in 1D. To find the cubic spline, if you have data in 1D, you have to solve a tridiagonal linear system very fast. It's also optimal in a certain sense. And if you ask yourself, of all possible imaginable function that goes through that set of data, which one wiggles the least? So, I mean, through that data point, you can draw you can draw all sorts of functions through that data points. And one way to measure that is to look at the integral of the square of the second derivative. That's roughly a measure of the curvature. And if you square it and integrate it, you get a total measure of how much wobbles that thing does. And if you ask, of all possible functions through that data, which wobbles the least, the answer is exactly the cubic spline, with a certain boundary condition, but that's another story. Problem with cubic spline is that you can generalize them to 2D if your data is on an XY grid, but if you have scattered data points, generalization of cubic splines used to be hopelessly awkward. So anyway, that's the background. Now, the first example of what's called a radial basis function is, suppose we consider the function x cube itself. X cube graphically looks like this and goes down like that. If you consider magnitude of x cube is a cubic on this side, then it will jump in the third derivative right there, and it'll be another cubic on the other side. So that is what magnitude x cube looks like. Consider again this problem. We have the same data points as before, and let's locate at location of this data point. Let's place a magnitude x cube function. At the location of this one, place a magnitude x cube. At the location of this, place one of this magnitude x cube. And then we ask ourselves, is there a linear combination of those magnitude x cubes such that the sum will actually go through all those given data points? So you ask, is there a... These are translates of a magnitude x cube, this part. Here I have unknown coefficients, so I ask for a linear combination of the translates of this thing. That's my function s of x. Then I require that that should hit all the data points. And to do that, that means that I have my data values, my unknown coefficient, and I can write it matrix times vector equal to vector. And it's a symmetric coefficient matrix, that is phi, which is this function, xi minus xj, that forms the matrix. And I can solve that. And I will get the combination, which will be piecewise cubic, and it will jump in the third derivative. It's just a funny way to create a cubic spline. And at first, it's an unusually dumb way to do it, because we did have a tridiagonal linear system to get a cubic spline for us. Now I cooked up another method that will require a full linear system to achieve the same task. However,
do all those functions have to go through zero at the jump? I mean, that's where you defined it.
I mean, there's nothing magical about... You mean this thing happened to be zero here? There's nothing magical about that. It's just that x cube happens to be zero at zero. And other... We are soon going to generalize this dramatically, and that property will disappear. Now, the beauty of this approach is that all of a sudden, that generalizes to high dimensions beautifully. So suppose now we have two space dimensions, x and y, and we have data that are the top parts of these lines. The bottom part is projection. Where is that data located in the xy plane? Well, instead of taking magnitude of x cube, I can take and rotate this thing so I get kind of a little funnel job. And then I can ask myself the question, so they now look like this, kind of. And they are actually another type of function, so they are not quite zero at the bottom, but anyway. And then I can ask a question now, what linear combination of those rotated things will go through all the right data values? And that will be a full linear system to solve. It will be exactly the same structure linear system. Made no difference that I'm in two dimensions instead of one. Data can be how scattered it wants. And it turns out that I can inherit all the good properties of the cubic spline to higher dimensions by this idea. And I can generalize it dramatically as well. Or I shouldn't say I here. We can. One can. When we think about cubic splines, we think about R cube and its magnitude, or R cube rotated. And one property I mentioned was, in one dimension, such an interpolant minimized the integral of the second derivative squared. Well, if you ask yourself the question, if you have scattered data in 2D, and now you can ask, you have data points, you want to ask, of all imaginable surfaces fitting data points, which one minimizes equivalent 2D of wobbles, which is a certain integral or square of derivatives in different directions. And it turns out there's a unique answer to that, and that answer is, do the same rotated basis function, but don't use R cube, use R squared log R instead, and you get an optimally surface in two dimensions as far as minimizing wiggles. However, the accuracy we get in cubic splines, we know that the accuracy, if you make a grid finer, the arrow goes down like h to the 4, which h is the step length. And the basic reason for that is that the magnitude x cube does have a jump in the third derivative. Now, that limits the accuracy. You'll get fourth order accuracy in interpolation and less in derivatives. And this one has a jump in the kind of three and a half derivative or something. So that again limits accuracy. But this concept of taking something rotated and linearly combined with translates of it. There's no reason to have functions that jump at all in any derivative. We can play the game with, and this is a very famous example, multi-quadric, which is square root of 1 plus r squared. Take this thing, swing that around, and we can put rotated versions of that at our data. And there's no jump in any derivative. And it turns out we right away get a spectrally accurate interpolation method out of this. And we can rotate Gaussians, the inverse quadratic we can rotate. We have all sorts of possibilities that will give you spectral accuracy rather than the accuracy of a typical spline. So, with this, let's now return to this cartography problem. And the contribution by Roland Hardy was that he invented the concept of radial basis functions for scattered data in more dimensions. And he chose the square root of 1 plus r squared as the thing to rotate. And to this day, that is probably the most popular choice, very good choice. And with that original data he played with, this is the surface he cooked up. And that's now an infinitely differentiable surface to fit his scattered data. And what we can notice is that contour lines here, they are nice and smooth, they look like a good map. We get a little bit of edge abnormalities. If it's at the very edge, we have extrapolation instead of interpolation, and it tends to buckle a little bit, but anyway, that is. And let me take off this by now. So what are the research issues in this context? Well, following Hardy's pioneering work, there were lots of developments, and one question is, suppose you scatter your data in three dimensions. Say you rotate the multi-quadrics in three dimensions. You get a big linear system to solve. Can that system ever be singular? Can the whole procedure break down? And major discovery by Michelli at IBM Yorktown Heights in 85 was just a general answer, no, it will not be singular. There's a tiny little requirement, but for example, with multi-quadric, we rotated Gaussians with inverse quadratic, with all those basic ones, this will never collapse. No combination of how you distribute the points in any number of dimensions will give you a singular system. Once that was discovered, research really took off here, and the group around Mike Powell in Cambridge, England, has done lots of students, lots of work on getting fast algorithms to solve it and investigate the convergence properties of this way to approximate scattered data. Can you use this now to solve PDEs? Well, it's very tempting because you have your scattered data points. You now can very smoothly fit an analytically, spectrally accurate surface through it. You have that surface in mathematically closed form. Therefore, you can take its partial derivatives. And therefore, we have now a means of scattered data, find partial derivatives, and then you can maybe step forward in time and solve a time-dependent problem. You can form a linear system, solve an elliptic problem. And the first pioneering work there was Ed Kanza. Lawrence Livermore in 1990, and there's been a lot more work on that since. And that is the aspect of radial basis functions that I will talk about here. Use them as a tool to solve PDEs. When we first started with this My Little Group, which was a couple of years ago, what we intended to do was to solve Maxwell's equations for electromagnetic waves. And if you have a, say, vacuum, then you may have a dielectric medium, and you have an interface between vacuum and the medium. If you are out in free space, there is no geometry constraints at all, and an XY grid, and run some high-order implicit method is as good as anything you can do. And but the problem is when you have this interface, so our thought was to scatter centers for radial basis functions around the interface, and there run, it's a fairly few points in a lower dimension than the whole volume of space, and there run radial basis function and combine the things up. And accuracy and cost, that was very attractive. Accuracy was spectral, no problem with that. Cost was not high, but we could never get time-stepping stability on the thing. So therefore, we decided to sort of backtrack and try to look into just what are the basic properties of this interpolation method. There were methods in the literature, I mean, analysis of error estimates, but it didn't really answer the question, do this approximation have a Runge phenomenon, like high over the polynomial oscillate like mad at the edges? Do they have the Gibbs phenomenon at the jump? I mean, what kind of properties do they have? So what I'll talk about first is a little summary of basic properties for them. And so issues now, as I said, were do radial basis functions have Gibbs phenomenon, Runge phenomenon? Another aspect is, if you take, say, Gaussian, we know what a Gaussian looks like. It looks kind of like this graphically. I can't do it with holding this one. A Gaussian function looks like this. And if you put in a little parameter epsilon here, and let epsilon go to zero, the Gaussian just gets flatter and flatter and flatter. Does it make any sense to let your basis functions be flatter and flatter and flatter? They get more and more ill-conditioned, because if they are flat, every basis function translates looks identical. So you get a horribly conditioned system. But what we are going to see, actually, accuracy goes up spectacularly if you make them flatter. So you get a very beneficial singular limit to play with here. And that's an aspect that we have been working on. another aspect, again, is you get ill-conditioned system. Is there a way to, in a stable numerical way, compute interpolants with such basis functions? And ultimately, we'd like to time step wave equations with the whole thing. So at this point, let me sort of outline where the rest of the presentation is heading. I'll show you a couple of slides on what happens out at the boundaries, illustrate how we can take experiences from cubic splines and carry them over to much more general scattered data, general radial basis functions, how to handle edge effects. Then I'll talk about what happens if you have basis functions that just go flatter and flatter and flatter. And what happens to the approximations of radial basis functions then? I'll describe an algorithm that actually allows you to do stable numerics even in that limit. I'll give you a few slides of examples of interpolants based on radial basis functions. How accurate are they? And then we're going to look into solving the Poisson equation using radial basis functions and some conclusions. And that's the number of slides if anybody wants to count them down and see when you can escape this room with dignity. Okay, maybe I should actually leave that up on the other board here if anybody wants to keep track. Okay. So boundary errors then. And say you have finite differences, and suppose your data is in one dimension and every data point is the value 1. Well, the standard interpolant will be identically 1 to such data. And actually, if you do radial basis function on data that is absolutely perfectly 1, you're in for an unpleasant surprise. It will already do a Runge phenomenon. It will oscillate heavily at the edges. Because it's equivalent to cubic splines, but cubic splines with a very funny end condition. Couple of ideas. In cubic splines, there is something called natural spline, and that is if you ask the second derivative to be zero at the two ends. Or there is a better way. That turns out that's not good. It gives you bad accuracy at the edges. A better way is to do what's called not-a-not, which is, for example, MATLAB's built-in standard. Not-a-not means that at a node point next to the boundary, you do not allow the jump in the third derivative. That's a not-a-not condition. That serves as a fine extra condition. Well, in the language of radial basis functions, at each data point, you put one of those magnitude x cubed, for example. And not-a-not means you remove the magnitude x cubed function from the next point next to the boundary and just place that one outside the boundary instead. If you do that with radial basis function, it turns out you perfectly reproduce the not-a-not for splines. But if you've done that, why don't we do it one more step? We can take out, for example, two points, two places inside, and move both of those outside. We can do that. And then we get something which we call super not-a-not here, which is not done in cubic splines, but it's a natural idea now that we generalize here.
Not a knot.
Because knot is where the cubics join themselves. So now the point, first point inside the boundary is not a knot, not a knot. So speaking about vocabulary, when we worked about this super knot and knot, we used to abbreviate that as knot method, but that's another story.
Then do you generalize this by putting more on, taking all the points out?
No, it turned out that doesn't quite do it. However, it's not a bad idea because it just tells you the freedoms we have. So here we have a test function which is just a hump like this graphically inside a unit circle. Throw on piles of radial basis centers and approximate it. Radial basis functions, I think we used let me see now, which one did we use here? I can't remember even which. I think we used multi-quadrics here, this square root of 1 plus r squared. Standard way to do it, not a knot, means we have took points inside the boundary and placed the centers for our expansions outside. So that means no irregularities allowed on that set. And immediately, the picture here is no error until 10 to minus 6 error. That means red. No error is blue. And it clearly improved the picture. And we did the super not-a-not. We moved out a little bit more, and you get a very good idea picture. Trying to control boundary errors by clustering points was not nearly as successful. So what we've done is we've taken the concept of not-a-not from cubic splines, carried it to more dimensions, brought it over to irregular points, and applied it to rotated something which is not at all cubics and which has infinite differentiable. And it turns out that it really helps us a lot here.
I just wondered if the knot removal strategy is basically just a scale phenomenon where the density at which you're sampling is also related to how many knots you remove and how you actually choose the point.
It is, I don't think a scale, but the idea for not a knot is that the edges are always the worst because you don't have data on both sides. So therefore you want to enforce a little bit more regularity at the edges and take away the freedom by allowing a jump near the edge. That kind of holds down and stops oscillations. I think that's a way of thinking about it. And the thing is that you can generalize it tremendously here and it still does a good job. Now, if you let basis functions go flatter, what happens then? So take multi-quadric, which is square root of 1 plus epsilon r squared. If epsilon goes to infinity, then you can basically ignore that 1, and you get square root of constant r squared. In other words, basis function will look like this, if epsilon is very large. If epsilon goes to 0, it basically becomes a flat one. So it just flattens itself out. This one, Gaussians, if you make epsilon 0, the Gaussian hump flattens itself out. Inverse quadratic, if epsilon is large, it will just be a spike at the origin. If epsilon goes to 0, it just flattens itself out. Now, take one-dimensional data and say just two data points. So you have at x1, the data is f1, at x2, data is f2. And each of those we are looking at epsilon small, so we can Taylor expand each of those functions. And let the Taylor expansion be constant plus something epsilon squared r squared, something epsilon 4, and so forth. Taylor expand the basis function. Then you can write down the linear system you have to solve, nice little 2x2 system, and you find what weights do you have to use. And you'll find that the weights will go to infinity if epsilon goes to 0. In this case, just like 1 over epsilon squared, and you get some algebra. And then you don't just want the weight, you actually want to find the actual interpolating function. So that means that you have to sum the weights against basis functions here. And if you work that out, this is the answer. Namely, if you look at this, you find that that is the interpolating straight line to the data. So in two dimensions, if you have 2 points here and here, you take basis functions and go flatter and flatter. That although the weights go to infinity, whereas you make epsilon go to 0, the actual interpolant will go to the interpolating straight line. And then comes now what happens if you have more data points. And so let's keep that up. And Driscoll and myself, we managed to prove this theorem that says that if you have any number of data points in one dimension, so you have n data points irregularly spaced in one dimension, do radial basis function and let the basis function go flatter and flatter and flatter. Yes, your weights will grow to infinity, but the actual interpolant of the data will go to the plain Lagrange interpolation polynomial, and that's it. In other words, what we have here with flatter and flatter basis function is an awfully ill-conditioned way to compute something that's totally trivial, namely Lagrange interpolation polynomial. So again comes the question, why would we do such a thing? Have we gained anything here? And what we've gained is that in 1D, we know our Lagrange interpolation polynomial. That's a uniquely determined polynomial of minimal degree. Point is, radial basis function carry over to arbitrary scattered data in arbitrary many dimensions. And they again still will have the limit. Let epsilon go to 0. There is a limiting radial basis function. It will carry the concept of polynomial over to higher dimension, where we no longer have the theorem that you have a unique interpolating polynomial. And now polynomials of high order is a basis for spectral methods and is the basis for finite different methods. And via this machinery of radial basis function going flatter, we can carry over to scattered data in more dimensions what we used to be able to do with polynomials in one dimension. That is the real importance here. So questions now are, as I just mentioned them, is this limit of flatter basis functions an unusually silly way to compute something trivial? And in 1D, maybe, but in 2D, we get spectral accuracy, we can handle scattered points, and we actually get totally novel spectral methods that do not require a regular geometry, do not require XY grid layout. We can do it on arbitrary grid setups. Now, is there a numerical way to stably compute as you have flatter and flatter basis functions? And it used to be dismissed as being hopelessly impossible. However, there is a great method for it, it turns out, that we have come up with. So let me explain that idea by looking at a seemingly unrelated problem. Let's consider this function, 1 minus cosine epsilon divided by epsilon squared. And let's just ask the problem, evaluate this function for epsilon very, very small, or epsilon equal to 0. Well, we have a problem here, because if you do it the immediate way, epsilon is small, cosine epsilon is about 1. 1 minus 1 will wipe out all our significant digits in floating point. And then we divide by epsilon squared. And what we'll find is that we just get a horrible answer if we do it straightforwardly. However, solution to that is, one way to solve it is, think of epsilon as a complex variable, not just a real variable. And then, in a complex plane, this is a complex epsilon plane, we want to calculate the function right there. We have a regime in the complex plane around here where numerics suffers from bad cancellation and we can't do it. However, this is a removable singularity as far as complex variables is concerned. In other words, we can pick up the value of the function here by averaging it around the circle, and that whole circle can be done out in the epsilon plane where everything is numerically safe and stable. So let that have that as a background now. And then we can turn to our RBF radial basis function problem here. You have data, function values. We had to solve a linear system to get our expansion coefficients. So you can write that symbolically. That expansion coefficient is the inverse of that matrix times our data. Then, having expansion coefficient, you must do a sum in order to get the interpolant. And you can write the sum as a vector times this thing. And matrix multiply, this doesn't depend on epsilon at all. That was our data vector. So this combination here, now that will, as epsilon go to zero, this inverse will blow to the sky. Multiplying by this vector, you will get a horrendous amount of numerical cancellation. However, as this theorem back there showed, the actual interpolant had a well-defined limit. So as epsilon go to zero, this times that suffers numerically, but limit exists perfectly well. And the essential observation now is it turns out that as epsilon go to zero, all these singularities we see here are removable singularities in the sense of complex variables. In other words, go out in a complex plane and make a swing in the epsilon plane, and all of a sudden, all ill conditioning has disappeared. This fact that when you had flatter and flatter basis functions, that was the limit of epsilon going to zero, that actually, as far as the interpolant goes, is a removable singularity, and therefore we can compute it stably. And let me expand a little bit on that. So here we have a case with actually 41 scattered data points in the unit circle. And if you let epsilon, this is a real line in an epsilon plane. So if you come in, epsilon go to zero means you come in along this line. I plotted a condition number of the coefficient matrix, and it will blow up to infinity. This is a log of the condition number. So epsilon going into zero, condition number blows through the sky. Turns out that there's no direction in the complex plane you can sneak in with your epsilon and get a better condition system. However, also in the complex epsilon plane, you have these poles. It turns out that for some complex values of epsilon, you get actually a singular system. So as far as condition number goes, you get isolated poles in the complex plane. But all this stuff in the middle here is a purely removable singularity for the interpolant. And algorithm, and I will be quick here. I should maybe say also, when I had this picture up, that the linear system you get with 41 points scattered like this, as epsilon go to zero, ill conditioning, yes. So if you look at the determinant of that system, the determinant is going to go to zero. So all columns of that matrix are going to go to one. Determinant goes to zero. And you can actually show that determinant of the linear system go to zero, in this case, like as epsilon raised to 416. And you can do that by Roche's theorem, you can pull it exactly. So you're talking ill conditioned here. Nevertheless, the whole thing is removable singularity. So algorithm you can cook up now is, in this complex epsilon plane, this is now real axis, imaginary axis. You want to calculate for real values of epsilon going smaller and smaller, because we know that then we get spectral accuracy on the whole thing. And what you need to do is just run a contour around it, compute around the contour. Had you not had spurious extra poles inside, the value in here would just be the average around that contour. And that will tell us in the interpolant. Now we have extra poles here. So what we do is, on the values pick up around the circle, we run a fast Fourier transform. Fast Fourier transform turns out, order you get coefficients out of fast Fourier transform is coefficients 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so forth. Had it been an analytic function with no singularities, it would have a Taylor expansion around the origin. And Fourier transform only picked up coefficients from this end and none from that end. And from these coefficients, we have got the Taylor expansion for small epsilon. Then we can calculate everywhere along this line numerically safely. But now we have extra poles here. Well, information from extra pole, they will cause a Lorentz expansion. Lorentz coefficients we pick up from this side of the Taylor of the Fourier transform, and we can do a Padé summation on them, and we can find them in rational form, and we can pull all those singularities out. So skip the details here. Point is, we can choose a contour, and we can compute perfectly stable for all epsilon values. We can compute the interpolants. Now, what does this do for us? Let me do now a few examples here. In this example, again, we've taken a function which is kind of a hump, and it looks like this graphically. It's now scattered points, 25 scattered points over square from 0 to 1, 0 to 1. And that particular function, this is a graph of it. So we run our algorithm, and we can then get the using multi-quadrics again, we can get the radial basis function interpolation to this surface. There is a limit as epsilon goes to zero, as basis function goes flatter and flatter and flatter. Now that limit, this is the interpolant we get by radial basis functions. Limit as epsilon goes to zero will be a function over this square. Then it turns out you get epsilon 2 times another function. That's the next order correction. All expandable in powers of epsilon. Epsilon 4, epsilon 6, and these are the surfaces. Surface corresponding to epsilon C, that's the limit of flat radial basis functions of multi-quadric type for that. Next correction term. Well, this one will have to take the right function values at all the points, whereas all the higher corrections must be zero at all your data points. And it turns out that you look at it, the limit of epsilon go to zero will have an error of, and we have to focus this thing better, the error will be, it's a lot better, 9 times 10 to minus 9. So we get 9 digits accuracy by only 25 points over this surface. Very, very, very accurate. It turns out that this actually, if you choose a little bit larger epsilon than zero, then you get a little bit of these correction functions coming in. And it turns out the best accuracy is actually to have epsilon a little bit away from zero. And this is a truly correction you can get down to even better than 10 to minus 9 fit here. So that's one example. One thing can go a bit funny. Let me put that on the other. In one dimension, limit of flat basis functions will give you a plain polynomial. For certain point distributions in 2D, it can be that make the basis function flatter, the interpolant blows to infinity. It can happen. And for example, if you put them in a perfect 5x5 grid and you use rotated multi-quadrics and make them flatter. This is the same start function as before. I just moved the location of the grid points. And this time, the multi-quadric interpolant you get, it doesn't start by S0, epsilon squared, epsilon 4. There's also a 1 over epsilon squared term. There is a 1 term on that left-hand side here. So in other words, if you let epsilon go to 0, this will blow up. However, we still have this term here, and this will be a beautiful-looking surface with the error 3.2 times 10 to minus 8. So it still is a spectacularly accurate interpolation of that surface. But this is not understood at all at this point. When does the limit exist and when does it not exist? If it does not exist, we have not at all lost our ability to use accurate interpolation here. Third example, and that is almost in the same vein, function in the same spirit, and this is what it looks like. This time, for some reason, our square is from minus 0.5 to 0.5. It doesn't matter at all. And we scatter 25 points in it. And what we show now is the log of 10 log of the maximum error of this of our radial basis function interpolant as opposed to the true function that we discretized. We're plotting log of max error against epsilon. So epsilon comes into zero here. Ill conditioning, if you just solved the straight problem from start by linear system. Ill conditioning would stop you from calculating after these lines get dashed stopped. However, with this contour method, we can keep on computing, and we see that there is indeed a certain epsilon value which gives us the best accuracy, and then we lose accuracy at the end again. And the accuracy we can get on this problem, well, we are down to again 10 to minus 8 here. Different radial basis functions, we base them on rotated Gaussians. If you base them on rotated inverse quadratics, rotated multiquadrics, they are not identical. They are different things, but they all work well. But they are not mathematically identical. In 1D, you get interpolating polynomial no matter what. In 2D, you get slight variations in the limits. Now, what happens to Poisson's equation here? And as I mentioned, applying radial basis functions to solving PDEs in irregular domain on scattered data points originated with Ed Kansai in 1990, and there's been quite a bit of literature since then. And if you take the simple Poisson problem of Laplacian of U equal to a given function F inside, and you put on the boundary U equal to G. And I don't think I wrote down the actual test function we used here, but anyway, in general, you take a domain like this. You throw some points at the edge, you throw some points in the inside. Your radial basis function approximation, just choose your favorite radial basis function, take a linear combination of it. That's a surface now. And you just demand that that will satisfy, that function you get here will satisfy the differential equation at the interior point, and it will satisfy the boundary condition at the boundary points. And you get a linear system to solve where you have the unknown expansion coefficient. In the right-hand side, you have just the g, the discrete value of the boundary at your boundary points. You have the discrete values of the right-hand side function at its points. And then the coefficient matrix is, the upper block here is just the phi at x minus xj evaluated at the boundary points. And the coefficients inside here is the Laplace operator on this thing evaluated at the interior point. So you can immediately, in MATLAB, you're talking three lines here, you throw up that system that you have to solve. And key features of doing this is spectral accuracy of the whole thing, and that is assuming your basis functions are not rotated x cubes, but rotated something differentiable, infinitely differentiable. As I say, complex arbitrary geometry and tiny code go to more space dimensions, the code doesn't get any longer, nothing gets more complicated. There are key features. Well, how do you solve the system fast? There is big progress on that, and I don't go into too much on that. How to avoid ill conditioning if you have many node points, that's also, if you put more and more node points in. We can let epsilon go to zero, we can use flatter and flatter basis functions via the contour machinery. That's no problem. But anyway, that is the original formulation by Kansa in 1990 of how to solve a Poisson equation using radial basis functions. And there are a couple of other suggestions that came up as well. And here is one. Somebody, Wu, in 1992, just suggested that we don't even have to use the same basis functions everywhere. At every point, we can use whatever basis function we want. So therefore, why don't you, at the boundary points, you use your standard phi. At the interior point, let's use Laplacian of the phi. That's also a fine basis function to use. And lo and behold, if you do that, the linear system you have to solve ends up a symmetric matrix. And that's usually much nicer numerically to deal with. And you often get positive definite matrices out of this as well. And then all of a sudden you can do conjugate gradient and such numerical algorithms. And there's another variation on the market as well at the moment, which I will not go into. And let's now do a test run on this. So let the solution to our Poisson problem be u x y equal to 100 divided by 100 plus something squared in x, something squared in y. This again is one of our bendy surfaces here. The ideas we want to compare is three methods: direct radial basis function collocation, pseudospectral in the best implementation we know how to do that, and finite differences in the best way we know how to do that. And in all cases, we do it on a unit circle. We use 48 nodes in the interior, and we use 16 nodes around the boundary. Just whatever. For radial basis functions, there's nothing special with being on a circle, and we toss the boundary points pretty uniformly, but not quite uniformly on the boundary. We just toss them out. It didn't matter how. We threw out the interior points slightly irregularly, but roughly uniformly spread. It turns out uniform is not at all optimal. It turns out later, but anyway, doesn't matter. Just toss them out. We compare that against pseudospectral. Pseudospectral in polar coordinates. Sometimes one thinks of polar coordinates as radius from 0 to 1 and angle from 0 to 2 pi. That's a way to think polar coordinates on a circle. That's a bad way for numerics to think about it, because in Chebyshev method, Chebyshev clusters nodes at the endpoints. And the only reason Chebyshev clusters at the end is that end is end of data. You have to come out to the boundary. You have to suppress the Runge phenomenon. High-order polynomial oscillating like mad. Therefore, Chebyshev compensates for that by clustering just in the right amount to balance out the Runge phenomenon. That's the heart of Chebyshev methods. However, at the center of a polar coordinate system, it is not the end of the world. If you go on the other side from the center, you still have data. So you should never cluster the points at the center of polar coordinates. You should always think polar coordinates as center is here, radius goes from minus 1 to 1, and it just rotate half the way around instead of all the way around. You've again covered the unit circle, but you've covered it much more effectively. So therefore, if you use pseudospectral on the unit circle, you should take Chebyshev distribution along each radius, but run it from one end right over to the other end. You should take equispaced and run Fourier in the angular direction. So there we have the pseudospectral grid for solving this Laplace problem, Poisson problem. And then finite differences. If you want to do finite differences on this, well, the natural thing is to do the same kind of grid, because we have to be radially, angularly lined up. But this time, there's no reason to cluster the points out at the boundary for finite differences. That's for high-order polynomials. So we do equispaced angularly, radially. We run so we skip the center point. We don't want to have trouble there. And we run equispaced around. So both of these methods depend heavily on the fact that we have the perfect circle geometry, whereas this one couldn't care less how we threw the points or care less what the geometry is. So now we run those three problems here. And result of that is as follows. So when we keep the problems up. So radial basis functions, pseudospectral, second order finite differences. The three colors here is radial basis function. We can choose what kind of function we should rotate to create our basis elements, basis functions. Rotated Gaussians are green. Rotated inverse quadratics are red. Rotated multiquadrics are blue. This is a log of maximal error, max norm of the our solution versus, I mean, the true solution to the problem, 10 log of that one. Here we have done, for the radial basis functions, we have a choice of this epsilon parameter. How flat do we want to have our basis functions? So that is 10 log is 0. That means epsilon equal to 1. Here epsilon equal to 0.1. Here epsilon is 0.01, etc. The error we get if we do second order finite differences, solve this linear system for that Poisson problem, we get a max norm error that, of course, has nothing with epsilon to do, so therefore it's a horizontal line here, of 6.8 10 to minus 5. That's the error we get by second order finite differences. Pseudospectral method will give us 3.5 10 to minus 9, and choosing the right value of epsilon, we can get all the way down to 9.7 10 to minus 13 accuracy. For radial basis functions here. So how does this now work out sort of cost-wise? Well, finite difference of second order, and that holds for finite elements of second order just the same. Second order method. That means that if you make your grid twice as dense, the error goes down by a factor of 4. That's the second order. On the other hand, if you make it twice as dense in two space dimension, your number of grid points also went up by a factor of 4. So in other words, if you want to use second order, either finite difference or finite elements, doesn't matter. And you want to get the error from 10 to minus 5 down to 10 to minus 13. That's 8 orders of magnitude difference here. In other words, we would have to increase the density of our method by 100 million times as many points. So instead of 48 grid points, we have to run 48 times 100 million grid points to get second order or finite elements, finite difference to that accuracy. So in other words, we've got a tremendous accuracy out of radial basis functions here. And again, pseudo-spectral method. Right now, this will lead to a sparse linear system. This will lead to a sparse linear system. This will, at the moment, lead to a full linear system. On the other hand, a full linear system of size 48 is not to sweat over. But there is plenty of work going on right now in how to apply multigrid, how to apply preconditioned iterative solvers, how to do domain decomposition in order to solve these systems fast that you get by radial basis functions. So if anybody kept track on those slides, you can breathe out now. Here is the status and conclusion. So status is, what's established is that there is no need for grids. You can just throw out your points. Once you've thrown out your points, in finite elements, if you throw out points, you have to decide how to connect them because you have to draw lines between points to form triangles. And in three dimensions, you have to have, between lines, you have to form tetrahedra, and you have to work on that. Here, you can just throw out points. You never connect them. There's no gridding issues coming up. Spectral rate of convergence. If you take more and more grid points in your domain, accuracy goes to see, accuracy increases beyond every fixed order, beyond second order, fourth order, sixth order, eighth order. It's spectral convergence, as long as your basis functions are smooth. And on top of that, you can let epsilon go to zero, and that also brings up the accuracy dramatically, up to a point. So this flat basis functions is particularly accurate. There is a numerical method to compute stable for any value of this shape parameter via contour integration. It's established that the approach works well for elliptic equations, and this was at the tiny little demo case on that. It's run very well for parabolic equations, and that is for general geometries and any number of space dimensions. What looks promising is there's been several papers very recently on domain decomposition methods that allows you to do this in subdomains and then couple the subdomains. And then every domain is so small that it's no big deal to do linear system on them. Also, replace Gaussian elimination by other iterative solvers. Very promising. And what we don't really have a grip of so far is do this for wave equations. Wave equations have no internal damping mechanism in them. Any sort of oscillations you do at one point is never forgiven, never forgotten. It will leave you with you in the true equation. It's not damped out. And how to get this thing stable for time stepping of such equations, that's open at the point. But anyway, that's pretty much the status of it. And I thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome any questions?
Of course, as long as it's easy ones.
Okay, only easy questions, please.
I'm not a numerical analyst, so when you say spectral accuracy, do you mean the spectral content of the solution?
No. A numerical method, if you have a grid by spacing H, many numerical methods, like second order finite differences, the error as you make the grid finer, we go like h squared, like trapezoidal rule for integrals, for example. Other numerical methods for integrals, Simpson's rule, you do something else, you have a grid of h, make h finer, accuracy goes like h to the fourth power. Other methods, fancier method, can be h to the sixth, h to the eighth. By spectral, I mean it goes beyond every power of h. So as you make grid finer, the error goes actually like a constant times e raised to minus something over h. Spectral in the sense that arrow goes exponentially fast to zero as h goes smaller, as opposed to like any power of h.
When you were talking about accuracy, are you talking about norms, or are you talking
max norm?
What about point-wise accuracy?
It makes essentially no difference in this context. We checked both, and what the arrows I displayed were the max norm of the functions. So it was not just point-wise. I mean, there are certain methods, in finite elements in particular, where you can get sort of super accuracy at certain points, and that is not part of this picture.
Any other questions, comments? Go ahead.
I just wondered to what extent, I know that if you give up spectral accuracy, then you can have things like, for example, compactly supported basis functions, and you can not use, you talk for Fisher as an example of a collocation method, but if you look at methods that are not exactly interpolating, then you can check different properties. I just wondered to what extent you could simplify the equations, not make them dense by using compactly
supported real basis function means that you are going to get a sparse instead of a full linear system, typically. And they have been pioneered and used heavily, especially by a group in Göttingen in Germany. And the experience is that your accuracy suffer badly from compactly supported basis functions. So therefore, what the hope is that we are going to come up with a fast numerical solver for the full systems so that we don't at all have to deal with this accuracy loss in compactly supported. I mean, that's the hope that guides our work here, that the compactly supported basis functions will be just, it's like, say, a multi-grid method. It allows you to solve global systems or multi-pole methods. It gives you very fast numerical algorithm, although the original system is full. And the hope is that there will come up fast algorithm here so that we can get the full, it seems like the global functions just are so much more accurate. We rather see get a numerical method to solve them fast than to, but possibly, I really think that will work out and that we don't have to deal with them.
So one thing I was thinking about,
yeah. Now, wavelets are highly oscillatory functions, so they compromise. So there's a compromise between Fourier and local and physical. Now, these are not oscillatory whatsoever. All these basis functions, indeed, I talk about making them flatter and flatter and flatter, and they are global. It's the least oscillating thing you can think of. So the hope is that that structure will lend itself, therefore, to multipole type ideas, because seen from a distance, all the basis functions look the same. Whereas seen from a distance, an oscillatory function, they don't at all look like the same. So there are certain things to go for real basis functions that hopefully we can work with global and find a fast algorithm. But who knows? I mean, this is not totally ready for prime time. It's an intriguing concept at this point. And there has been, as I say, lots of work on locally supported but not successful numerically at this point. And the story for wavelets is probably totally opposite.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit. The examples you showed us were surfaces which were fairly smooth.
Yes.
Right? And that's always the knock against spectral methods. You know, they say it only works for smooth problems.
Yeah.
Have you tried it for things that vary a little bit more abruptly than the functions you use?
We have, and one of the strengths of this radial basis function is that you throw your grid points as you please. You are not limited to regular grids at all. And that gives you the option of refining grids as you need and overcome that in a way that you cannot well with regular spectral methods. So we have played a little bit with it, and definitely if you have a function that all of a sudden does something and then is smooth again, you should probably have more local radial basis functions in the area. Maybe you should throw in more functions in that area. We have not explored that. This is a concept at the moment. But there's so many things to play with in this game. So,
again, in the same vein, and I'm a practitioner as you are, so I'm really throwing out the criticism I've heard. in many applied problems, you really don't want that enormous accuracy, okay? And the issue is, can spectral methods be applied to those kinds of problems where you're not interested in the kind of accuracy you showed us, but just cruder answers and get answers faster than other methods?
Well, I would imagine. I mean, you can use really, really coarse grids here. Right. So, yes, spectral methods pay off if you want 10 to minus 10. If you want to check, for example, if solitons interact exactly or something like that, you want to have superb machine accuracy. Now, then spectral methods shine. If you want an engineering accuracy of 10 to minus 1, 10 to minus 2, it could very well be that coarse finite difference finite elements will be cheaper. So preference of method depends very much on what accuracy level you want. And as you say, it's absolutely correct. Spectral methods is basically, if you want very high accuracy, then they particularly pay off. But for example, in wave equations, you often do want that because they are unforgiving. You may want to run waves with no dispersion over very long times, things like that. Then you truly need it. That, of course, is a case where you can't run this on at the moment, but that's another story. You have to start somewhere.
Any other questions? Well, if not, I want to thank you, Bengt, for a really marvelous, clear lecture. And we have a little gift in addition to all your expenses. It's the official IAM mug.
Thank you very much.
To take back to Colorado and have all those great undergraduates see it and come to you.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay.
Thank you.